It's 8:09 on Friday, June 15th. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. She'll be back on Monday. You're listening to our Friday Week in Review. At this time each Friday, we talk about the top news stories from the past week and hear what our guests from the left and the right to say about those. You can join our conversation as well. Call in with the news that got your attention from the past week. Our toll-free number is 800-642-1234, anywhere you can hear my voice. In the Madison area, try our local line, 263-1890, 263-1890. And if you'd rather use the internet, you can send us an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. Our guests today, Rick Berg, former appointee of the Thompson administration, freelance writer and contributing columnist for the Wisconsin State Journal and the Capital Times, and a board member of Wisconsin Common Cause, and Bill Leaders, news editor of Isthmus, Madison's alternative newspaper. He's also president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council and author of Cry Rape. Gentlemen, welcome to the broadcast. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, let me see if I can get all the mics up and try that again. Lots of issues to talk about and lots of things going on in the world. Let's start on the international scene. We've got this conflagration seemingly going on now in the Gaza Strip, the Palestinians fighting amongst themselves, and it just seems to be one thing after another over in the Middle East. Who wants to take that one first?
Well, I'll jump in on that. You know, it's a really sad development. I'm sure that there are lots of people who are pleased to see Palestinians killing each other because it saves them the trouble of doing it themselves. But what you have now is really a divided Palestinian population with Hamas in control of Gaza and Fatah in charge of the West Bank. And both of these are places that are extremely isolated and extremely vulnerable to the pressures that the economic that the world community can bring on them. My concern is that that is what's going to happen as punishment for Hamas taking over this area, that there'll be severe economic sanctions imposed on that area. And economic sanctions, as a rule, don't affect the people in power so much as they affect the people in the population. And so there'll be great suffering that will be brought to bear on the people in that area because the leadership of that area is not to the liking of the people who have the power to punish them. That's a tragic development. I will say, too, that this development doesn't have to bring greater instability to the region. It doesn't have to lead to more violence. There are opportunities here for diplomacy. There are opportunities here to reward moderation, to reward a willingness to work with each other, and it could possibly evolve into something better. I don't have a lot of optimism because I think there will be people who try to milk this as a way to inflame tensions and to further violence.
Well, the situation doesn't have to lead to additional violence, but I'm guessing it will. I mean, I was struck. You know, we got some news summaries, of course, as we always do before we appear on the show, and there's a couple that really jumped out at me regarding this situation. Here's one news account. One witness says that Hamas gunmen have been bringing men out of the building and executing them in the street in front of their wives and children. Then in another account, it says Hamas gunmen hugged each other and handed out pastries to onlookers. So I guess after you bring out the men and shoot them in front of their wives and children, then you hand out the pastries. I mean, it's a really sad situation, and I think it again points out, you know, this whole war on terror and extremism, and there are people being victimized by it in the Middle East right now, and certainly in Palestine and in the Gaza. I mean, most people in the Middle East, it seems to me, want to live in peace and harmony and with economic progress and all the things that most people want. But we've got this element in the Middle East, and we see it in Iraq and Afghanistan and you know, in the Middle East, throughout the Middle East, and frankly, even around the world. And it points out the nature of what we're battling across the world today. And it's this extreme ideology that people want to impose on others through violence. And it's unfortunate.
You know, I'd be wary of that story. I looked at other press accounts. I read what I could in the New York Times and other media. I didn't see it repeated anywhere, this story of Hamas gunmen dragging out people in the street and executing them in front of their wives and children. That's the type of story that I think circulates whether or not it's true. And, I'm not saying it's not true, but I'm just careful about affirming that as an accurate report based on seeing it in one place. That's a pretty cold thing to do. Jeez.
It is, if it's true. And of course, and as you say, maybe we can't believe everything we
and
read in the
you
papers.
You hear these stories all the time in war. I remember, I don't remember the exact time or context, but there was this story of soldiers dragging babies out of incubators and destroying the incubators and letting them die on the hospital floor, which is this horrific tale that ultimately was researched and proved to have, you know, no truth whatsoever to it. So beware.
Well, there's certainly a lot of information floating around out there, and information consumers always have to check sources and be careful about what they're getting and keep an open mind. Something else going on in the Middle East, of course, there was the bombing of the shrine in Iraq. Now it seems like the Al-Qaeda fighters are being fought against by the insurgents in Iraq, and they're working with United States military units to against Al-Qaeda. So that's an interesting development over there.
Well, I think the additional bombings that took place at the mosque are exactly what it's a repeat of what happened originally. It's an effort on the part of those who were fighting democracy in Iraq to inflame the passions of the people of Iraq. And they saw that it succeeded the first time, and I think they just went for a repeat. So far there's been no evidence that it has really done that. So in terms of a trigger mechanism, the most recent bombing hasn't inflamed the people quite the way the first one did, because I think they're starting to see through what's going on over there a little bit, which points to your second point about some of the insurgents now working with American and Iraqi police forces. That is a very hopeful development, I think, in Iraq. And I think, you know, I don't want to be Pollyannish about Iraq, and I've been critical of the way the war has been managed as well. But I think it's a hopeful step in the right direction, and it's not the end of the line, but maybe things really are starting to turn around there a little bit and head in a more hopeful, stable direction. At least that's my wish.
The sun will come out tomorrow.
I hope so, Bill.
I don't know. I mean, I don't see good news coming out of Iraq in any respect. The United States' decision to side with some Sunnis in the battle against Al-Qaeda, supposedly, and to arm them seems to me a very troubling development. For us to be injecting arms in on the side of a particular insurgent group so that they will fight the people we regard as even more our enemy strikes me as a really reckless thing to do. We may end up arming both sides of a civil war in that country.
Well, then I presume you're troubled by Iran's involvement in Iraq as
well. I don't know about Iran's involvement.
Well, I think there's plenty of evidence.
Because when the Bush administration says there's plenty of evidence, I don't know whether to believe them. Frankly, they could be lying, just as they were about weapons of mass destruction. When they came out 3 years ago or 4 years ago and said, we have absolute positive, incontrovertible proof that there are weapons of mass destruction, there are chemical stockpiles, there are nuclear ambitions, we know all this to be a fact. That's what they said, and they were completely wrong about all of that. So I don't take their word when they say that Iran is arming insurgents in Iraq.
Well, I understand the point about credibility, and I don't totally disagree with that. But that doesn't mean that there hasn't been some compelling evidence on Iran's involvement. But I understand what you're saying in terms of being skeptical about the official Bush administration line. But it's pretty clear. I think it's pretty clear from what I've read that Iran's got a hand in Iraq.
Well, there's also a difference that could be in play here between whether there are Iranians who have a hand in supporting some of these insurgents movements and whether the government of Iran is principally involved.
A fine distinction, which I will accept, of course. But I'm guessing that the government is probably involved, but we really don't know.
We don't know.
It's going to take a while to sort out what's really going on.
And when the Bush
there.
Administration assures us that it's so, I don't know why anybody would believe it.
We're, of course, in the midst of the Week in Review here on Wisconsin Public Radio, something we do at 8 o'clock every Friday. We're joined today by Rick Berg, former appointee of the Thompson administration, freelance writer and contributing columnist for the Wisconsin State Journal and the Capital Times, and a board member of Wisconsin Common Cause. He's giving us the conservative point of view this morning. And Bill Leaders, news editor of Isthmus, Madison's alternative newspaper. He's also president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council and author of Cry Rape. He is giving us the position of the left. I'm still waiting for this program to feature a radical moderate. That will be a happy day for me.
I'll forward some names.
We'll be right back and take a call or two and discuss some more topics of interest on the Week in Review. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:21. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson sitting in for Joy Cardine, who will be back in this chair and in front of this microphone, or behind it, depending on your point of view, on Monday morning. We're in the midst of our Week in Review, our weekly look at the stories that made headlines around the world and in our state and around the country, and we'll try and get to as many stories as we can. There's always a ton of stuff going on. And we have two guests with us who are giving us various points of view on each of these issues. Rick Berg, who's a former appointee of the Thompson administration, freelance writer and contributing columnist for the Wisconsin State Journal and the Capital Times, and a board member of Wisconsin Common Cause. And Bill Leaders, news editor of Isthmus, Madison's alternative newspaper. He's also president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council and author of Cry Rape. Well, a bipartisan group of Senate backers of President Bush's stalled immigration bill has been huddling with Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff. They were hoping to attract enough support from skeptical Republicans to revive a plan to grant legal status to up to 12 million illegal immigrants. So immigration's still on our minds, and I've got a news clip of President Bush talking about the immigration issue, which we will listen to right now.
Some members in there are... believe that we need to move a comprehensive bill. Some don't. I understand that. It's a highly emotional issue, but those of us standing here believe now is the time to move a comprehensive bill that enforces our borders and has good workplace enforcement, that doesn't grant automatic citizenship, that addresses this problem in a comprehensive way.
That's President Bush talking about immigration, which continues to be a hot topic not only in the nation's capital but around the country wherever candidates for president are on the stump. And, Bill, why don't we start with you on this one?
Well, I think the defeat of the immigration bill and the challenges that it faced have a lot to do with the public having a lot of anger toward people that they regard as illegal immigrants and, you know, people who they somehow are convinced are stealing the services and resources of this country without giving anything back. And I think that's just a factually incorrect position with regard to the role that immigrants play in our economy. They're doing jobs, they're paying taxes, they're contributing to the well-being of this country for the most part. Their rate of criminal activity is lower than the population at large. People who are illegal immigrants pay an estimated $7 billion more into the Social Security system than they take out each year. You know, this whole public perception that immigration, that illegal immigration is run amok and we need to find these lawbreakers and kick them out, and we can't have any sort of accommodation, we can't have any sort of program that could be called amnesty or that allows them the possibility of citizenship is just wrongheaded.
Rick?
Well, the numbers are elusive, but most say that there are 12 to 20 million people in this country who are here illegally. And there's so many. I mean, it's a complex issue. I mean, enforcing the law, there's nothing wrong with enforcing the law. This is not an issue of race. This is not an issue of Hispanics. This is a question of law and whether or not the United States of America is going to enforce federal law, whether the United States of America is going to secure its borders, whether the United States of America is concerned about people who are interested in entering this country illegally, not to work and contribute to our society, but to enter this country illegally to do harm to this country. And I think that's where a lot of the anger flows from. In addition, there are people all around the world, talented, good people, who have been waiting years to enter this country illegally, to go through a process that
legally,
in some cases, legally, yeah, that in some cases, thanks, that in some cases takes years to complete. And they see these other people streaming across the open borders, minimal enforcement or no enforcement. You know, it's a question of fairness and it's a question of law. And in terms of the burden that these people put on our society, I think it's undeniable. I mean, they work, yes, they may pay taxes in some cases, yes. Good people, most of them, I'm sure, are. But at the same time, they put a burden on the school system. They put a burden on the healthcare system. And it's very difficult to get a handle on exactly what that cost is. And as far as the politics of it, I mean, if Bush had set out to destroy what little base he had left in the Republican Party, I don't think he could have come up with a better plan. I mean, the few people that were supporting this guy are now abandoning him in droves. I don't know where it's going to go in Congress. I understand the frustration and the anger and the grassroots outrage that flooded Congress, and rightfully so. I'm not sure you're going to see this bill pass, but time will tell.
You want to see a burden, you should see what would happen if these 12 to 15 million workers were suddenly to disappear overnight. This economy would not survive. I mean, some people seem to think, like, you know, these restaurants run on their own and their offices clean themselves at night, and, you know, they're the salad, the lettuce that ends up on their plate picks itself and magically appears. The fact is that immigrant labor is essential to the operation of our economy. We could not survive as a nation without it.
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure I totally buy that. Migrant labor was essential for many years in the fields of this country, certainly for purposes of agriculture and crops and all that sort of stuff. And that system worked pretty well for a long time. But now we've got a totally different I think it's something of a myth to say that all these people are here to do work that Americans won't or can't do. I just don't buy that. I know there's anecdotal stories to the contrary, I think it was a meat processing plant or something in Iowa where they went through and swept out a whole bunch of illegal people there. I can't remember. I think it was in the hundreds or something like that. But anyway, the next day they had Americans, legal Americans, lining up outside the plant to get those $18 an hour jobs. So I think it's something of a myth to say that they're here doing work that we just that legal Americans just won't do.
Well, I do almost exclusively reporting that's based on tips from ordinary people calling my attention to something that happens in their lives that concerns them. I've been doing it for more than 20 years. I've never gotten contacted by someone who said they tried to get a certain kind of job, but they weren't able to because an illegal immigrant had it, and that's what was blocking them.
Well, you hear it nationally. I mean, I don't know about it around here, but you certainly hear it nationally.
You made a point before about how there are these people who are waiting to get in legally, and they wait for years and years and years. But there's no direct connection between the difficulties that they encounter that way and the fact that some people are getting in illegally. It's not like someone is saying, oh, certain number of people snuck in illegally, therefore you can't come in. It's not a connected phenomenon.
Well, it is connected in the sense that we have a process in this country that's been defined for people who want to come to this country to live, work, or become a citizen. And it seems to me that everybody should be required to play by the same rules. That's fairness to me. But if you have one game that pertains to people who live on our southern borders, who can just sort of waltz across the border and come into the country more or less unfettered, and another game that says you're going to have to, if you're a European and you want to come here and live, work, become a citizen, you have to go through this very elaborate, long process, and it's going to take you, maybe months, perhaps years. I mean, there's a fairness element there for me.
Another interesting aspect to this story is the split within the Republican Party between business interests and the more cultural conservative wing. Business interests are well served by immigrant labor, and it's been a source of cheap labor for them, and they now find themselves at odds with the other half of the party who feel, as you do, Rick, that this is a matter of law and we should be enforcing the law. How's that going to play out in the as the political campaigns move forward toward the presidential election of 2008?
Well, a bit of a political train wreck, it seems to me. I mean, how is the nation's interest served by having a permanent underclass of low-paid workers flooding into the country. You know, I understand, on one hand, business wants to hire labor at the cheapest rate possible. But, you know, what happened to all the talk in the 90s about the high-skill, high-wage economy that we wanted for Wisconsin and for this country, and we want a well-educated workforce and all this? Suddenly, we've come to the point where, we need to bring millions and millions and millions of people here to do these unskilled jobs that no one else wants to do. Well, you know, I don't quite understand it, and it's caused a real fracture in the Republican Party. You're absolutely right. You've got these sort of, and I don't know how to describe it other than greedy business people who want to hire the cheapest labor they can find. You know, after we complained for years and decades about cheap labor in Asia and China and the sweatshops and all this stuff, now we want to import our own millions and millions of cheap laborers. I don't quite understand that. So you've got these greedy business guys who for the sake of profits or whatever, want to hire the cheapest labor they can find. Well, I think that there's some obligation upon them to first offer those jobs to Americans, if not to pay a living wage to Americans, you know, who can do those jobs if the job demands that sort of wage. I don't understand it. But it has fractured the Republican Party. There's no doubt about it. And I'm not entirely sure how that fracture is going to be mended before the 2008 election, but it's going to have to somehow get resolved. I don't know how.
Let's move on to some other issues. We've got quite a bit left to talk about here this morning, and I'd like to get to some state news as well. So, why don't we just jump to some state news? Democratic Governor Jim Doyle says Republicans need to move past rhetoric on the state budget and pass it. Meanwhile, Assembly Speaker Mike Hipch says he doesn't care how long it takes for the state budget to pass his chamber, even though it's supposed to take effect on July 1st. And I think we have a piece of audio from Governor Doyle. Let's listen to that real quick.
These are going to be some tough fights that we're going to have. Let's have them now. May as well have them in June and July and August as opposed to October. It's not going to get any easier as you move out into the fall.
Governor Doyle talking about the state budget, and it was interesting to me watching the budget process this time with an 8-8 split in joint finance, how the rhetoric was much different than it has been in past years, and it almost seemed like everybody was getting along, but is this a signal now that the gauntlet has been thrown down, the gloves are off, and it's going to get bloody from here on in? Rick, why don't you start this time?
I think the answer is probably yes. You know, the governor's right in the sense that if the battle lines are going to be drawn, we might as well hash it out now as opposed to waiting. It's not going to make it any easier to wait until August or September. And it's pretty clear from Speaker Hipsch's comments that the battle lines are drawn. And the Assembly Republicans are not interested in going along with the massive hike in the cigarette tax or the attempt to try to levy a new tax on the oil companies that would clearly pass its way down to the consumers at the pump. So the Republicans have sort of, in the Assembly, have sort of taken the traditional, we're not going to go along with all these big tax hikes role that they've played for some time now, and I think that's where most of the people in the state are. And then you've got the Democrats who control the Senate and the governor's office who want to see these things be part of the final package. So it's going to be interesting. In the end, I'm guessing what you're going to see is there'll be a lot of back and forth rhetoric, some of it sharp on both sides and targeted at the others. But in the end, I think you're going to see some sort of compromise, some sort of moderation, as you always do in cases like this. It's rarely one side wins all. Lest we forget, the governor of the state of Wisconsin has the most powerful veto pen in the country. And when it's all said and done, the governor can craft just about anything he wants to craft out of the language that's sent to him by the legislature. But
that's probably why Doyle is saying, just get me something quick.
Well,
so
sure.
I can
get me something and I can take
so
care
I can
of it.
Write it into what I want it to be.
Meanwhile, you have people suggesting that Fred Risser is holding up legislation in the Senate that would outlaw the so-called Frankenstein veto. It has to be a huge advantage for the Democrats to have the Senate and the governor's mansion as well in this budget debate. What can Republicans really do to force the governor to have to compromise. Bill, why don't you take that one?
Well, they can stop the passage of the budget bill. I mean, it's been sometimes as late as October before this budget bill has passed in past years, and it's supposed to pass by the end of June, I believe. But if the Republicans are going to draw the line and say, no, you can't tax the gas companies, and no, you can't increase the cigarette tax dramatically, they're going to have to come up with a plan. What other taxes are they going to create to raise the revenue that the state needs? What programs are they willing to cut? What are they willing to throw overboard in order to make up for the shortfall of money? The state of Wisconsin, unlike the federal government, can't spend money that it doesn't have. And so, you know, if they're going to say no to these things, which to me seem like pretty sensible things to tax, and my heart's not going to bleed for the oil companies making record profits if they have to pay a little bit more in taxes in the state of Wisconsin. And my heart's not going to bleed for people who are killing themselves with a dangerous product if they have to pay a little bit more for that pack of cigarettes. So,
well,
particularly
and
if the money goes to serve health programs as is intended.
And I think it's also important to note, though, that regardless of how the budget drama plays out, and we could speculate endlessly about that, a lot of what's going on is posturing for the next election cycle. I mean, let's just be candid about it.
It's point scoring. Yeah.
Right. It's posturing and point scoring. And so the Republicans want to make sure that they make sufficient noise about their concern regarding the levels of taxation in the state of Wisconsin and not being a party to hiking those in ways that they're not comfortable doing. And so some of what you're seeing going on now is simply positioning for the 2008 election cycle. And I understand that. I mean, that's politics. That's all part of it. And both parties do it. It's not just the Republicans. The Democrats do the same thing. And that's, I think, part of why you see the governor going after big oil and all this sort of stuff. I mean, they're all trying to read where the public mood is and appear as though they're doing something to respond in a positive way to it. But in the end, as Bill said, if the Republicans are going to block these revenue sources, it is sort of incumbent upon them to come up with an alternate strategy and to lay out what their vision is for the state budget.
But, you know, the budget was introduced by the governor, what, late January, early February?
Right.
I mean, everybody knew this was coming.
Sure.
So now the fiscal year starts July 1st. And I'm not supposed to have any opinions, but it just seems to me these people are getting paid to pass a budget by the end of the fiscal year so that when we start July 1, we've got a new budget in place. Why can't they get their work done on time? I'd get fired if I was that late all the time.
Well, that's a reasonable point of view. But, Bill, you can tell me, when was the last time the state had a budget passed and signed into law by July 1st? I mean,
I can't remember.
Can you, Bill?
They've been late. They haven't always
they've
been
always
late
been
this
late.
Fall.
I think Patrick Lucey
might
have been the
late.
Governor at that point.
Maybe. Or Gaylor Nelson might have been governor.
Well,
Warren
Knowles, it's been a while. But, I mean, you know, sitting as somebody, I mean, I'm not part of the legislative process. I read this stuff all the time in the newspaper. I hear the stories on the radio. And I had the co-chairs of Joint Finance on this program earlier in the week. And I sort of, in a milder fashion, asked the same question. You knew this was coming. You know, why didn't we just fix it now? Why does it have to take until October to get this stuff done? And probably the average person on the street would maybe have the same question. In the same level of frustration.
I'll tell you one reason why they drag it out is because the longer that they can deliberate and dicker over the state budget bill, the longer they have a period of time where special interests can throw money into their campaign coffers.
Exactly.
You know, if they drag it out and drag it out and drag it out, more and more money comes in from the interest groups that are trying to save their particular bill of interest or trying to protect their particular cause. And, you know, it's good for the lawmakers to drag that out as long as possible, especially since there's no effective regulation on the ability of these lawmakers to fundraise while the budget is under consideration.
So the answer to your question, John, I think is fundraising and posturing. That's why we never have a budget by July 1st. They're two valuable goals that we can't sacrifice to the calendar.
And I don't know whether either one of those are in the job description of a legislator.
No.
Both of them add up to no good reason.
Right. That's right. That's exactly right.
Okay. Well,
one plus one equals no good reason.
Hopefully, I still have a job at 9 o'clock this morning. Let's see how that goes. This is the Week in Review on Wisconsin Public Radio's Ideas Network. John Munson sitting in for Joy Cardine. She'll be back on Monday, refreshed and vacated from her vacation, and she'll be happy to be back at the microphone, I'm sure. I'm talking with Rick Berg, who is former appointee of the Thompson administration, a freelance writer and contributing columnist for the Wisconsin State Journal and Capital Times, and a board member of Wisconsin Common Cause. He's giving us the conservative viewpoint this morning. And Bill Leaders, who's giving us the view from the left. He's news editor of Isthmus, Madison's alternative newspaper. He's also president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council and the author of Cry Rape. We're going to talk about Michael Moore after we come back. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:41. You're listening to the Week in Review on Wisconsin Public Radio's Ideas Network. John Munson sitting in for Joy Cardine. Well, before the break, I mentioned we'd come back and talk about Michael Moore. And indeed, I'll make good on that promise. Controversial director Michael Moore has accused the United States government of harassment following an investigation into a visit he made to Cuba to shoot scenes for his new movie, Sicko. Cuba is under a trade embargo from the United States, and a majority of Americans are not allowed to visit the island. Last month, the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control started an investigation into Moore's Cuba trip. Moore's lawyer said in a statement, "This is an attempt by the government to discriminate against a journalist based on the content of Michael Moore's journalistic work." And we have a caller who has that issue on his mind. Let's join Art in Milwaukee. Art, thanks for hanging in there. You're on the air.
Sure. Thank you. Well, aside from being terrific publicity for Moore's movie, which seems to be common, it seems to me that, you know, Fred Thompson went after Moore, and my response is that if Thompson thinks that Moore's movie is going to be a slanted view of Cuba, what he and other candidates should do is say that let's let the average American go to Cuba, see for ourselves, not have to have things filtered through. You know, the Cuban healthcare system is, it's a poor country. They put all their money into preventive medicine. They produce about the same results as we do at maybe, you know, 2% of the expenditure, and the rest of the world is studying it. And the average Cuban could learn a lot from people in the U.S., and the average U.S. person could learn a lot from the lifestyle in Cuba. And I think it's time for us to be able to go for ourselves and not have to see Michael Moore's version or NBC or CBS's version.
Thanks a lot for the call.
I'll agree to this extent. The U.S. embargo on travel to Cuba, which has been in place, I don't know, 30, 35 years, has produced not a single positive result. No good has come from it. All it's done is to perpetuate ignorance of both countries toward each other. And the government's so-called investigation in this is probably has no real effect other than to generate PR for Michael Moore's new film. He must be thrilled with news of this.
Rick Berg?
Well, you see, I came today to prepare to discuss Paris Hilton in jail, not Michael Moore in Havana. So I
hoped to keep this a Paris Hilton-free hour.
Yeah, well, there you see, I just blew that, so I'm sorry. But I agree with Bill in the sense that the embargo on Cuba and travel to Cuba and doing business with Cuba has really, I don't think, done much of anything in terms of U.S. Economic policy or internally what's going on in Cuba. But the one, and I'm sure that will change. I think I'm just a matter of once Fidel leaves the stage, then I think you're going to see some changes. And at some point in the not too distant future, I think you're going to see normalization of relationships between Cuba and the United States. I think that's clearly coming. But what I don't understand is this sort of romantic view of Castro that some take. I mean, the guy is basically a dictator. He's been in power for a long time. There's nothing to be romanticized about, life under Castro in Cuba. But maybe there are some good things going on in Cuba that we could learn from. And I'm sure that given, time, we will.
We don't know that Michael Moore, well, at least I don't know that Michael Moore's new film romanticizes Castro. I think it points out that the little nation of Cuba has a healthcare system that in some respects is fairer, more accessible, and superior to the one in the United States, which is a heck of a point to make if you're trying to call attention to the flaws of our healthcare system here in the U.S. I really look forward to this film. I think Michael Moore is a brilliant filmmaker. I grant that he's primarily an entertainer. He's not strictly a journalist, but he makes films that are audacious and funny and generate discussion, and they're important.
And he makes a lot of money doing it.
That's right.
Well, so
there
do lots go. Of people.
Nothing wrong with money.
Nope.
It's the love of money is the root of all evil, actually.
That's what I hear.
That's what the Bible says. The Wisconsin Supreme Court is taking action to strengthen the state's open meetings law. The court adopted a new standard this week that requires governmental bodies to be more specific in notifying the public about the subject matter of upcoming meetings. The court says government should be most specific when matters of great public interest or that are unusual in nature will be discussed. The law requires governmental bodies to notify the public of the time, date, place, and subject matter of meetings. In adopting the standard, the court says that the Toma Area School District violated the law in 2004 in its handling of a controversial new contract with a teachers' union. Several people were protesting a provision that would give union members preference over other candidates for coaching jobs. The court says the board's meeting notice was too vague because it said only that employment matters would be discussed. The court says the notice should have specifically said that the union contract would be considered. Bill, I know that you were interested in this issue. You asked about it specifically at the beginning of the program, and why don't you go ahead and get started on that one?
Well, this is a very important decision by our Wisconsin Supreme Court. This is a case that my group, the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council, has tracked over the years with great interest. It has never before happened that our state Supreme Court has clarified exactly what the open meetings law means when it says that public bodies have to give notice of the things that they're going to take up. You know, how specific do they have to be? And this court decision, which was really brought about because of the activism and the persistence of a single individual, Brian Buswell, a citizen of Toma, who was concerned about something that happened at the school board level in his community. This decision says quite clearly that public bodies do have a responsibility to provide detailed notice of what it is that they're going to be discussing. And when there are issues that are of public concern, of particular public interest, they have to recognize that and be even more vigilant about making sure that the public is aware that of what it is that they intend to take up and what it is they intend to act on. They can't put out some vague and misleading notice so that people who have a huge interest in a particular topic aren't even aware that it's coming up for discussion and action.
Rick?
There's no conservative position in favor of secrecy. I totally agree with what Bill said, and I have long felt that the public business should be accessible and transparent. And that it's important for governmental bodies, when they're conducting public business, to be as explicit as possible when it comes to what are the matters that are going to be under discussion. And I say that as someone who has held public office. I mean, I was elected to 2 terms on the Madison Board of Education. We dealt with this issue all the time. And I think what we need is less secrecy in government and more openness. Bill, there's no difference, I don't think, between Bill and I when it comes to that issue.
There isn't, and I appreciate your thoughts on it, but there is a conservative position in favor of secrecy. It's called the Bush administration.
Well, that's one brand of conservatism. It's not necessarily mine.
Yeah, and I don't mean to beat up on that. I mean, I will say that some conservatives, and particularly our presidential administration, are great fans of secrecy, but it isn't an ideological thing. There are people on the left who would prefer to conduct their business, their public business, in secret, too, and that's why these laws exist, and that's why it's important when a court like our Wisconsin Supreme Court comes into the picture to come down firmly in favor of the public's right to know.
Well, I'll tell you what struck me about this story this week. I consider myself someone who's reasonably well-informed. I stay on top of the issues. I mean, I'm in the media business. I hear the news all the time. I'm reading newspapers and talking with people. I work with governmental agencies. I work for a governmental agency. And I was surprised. My assumption had been, this shows how naive I I was, my assumption had been that this kind of detail was already required. Because when I see the agendas that I see coming through our fax machine at our bureau up in Superior are usually quite detailed. I mean, it's the entire agenda, including all action items and what's going to be discussed at meetings. And I was kind of surprised by this case. It hadn't dawned on me that that wasn't already a requirement and that government entities weren't necessarily living up to that.
Well, the court says that it is a requirement, and it affirmed that this is what public bodies should be doing, and some already are, it's true. But what happened here was really a case of a public body trying to slip something under the radar. And unfortunately, there was some earlier court decisions, an appellate court decision, which gave some substantiation to that, that gave some basis for that position. What the Supreme Court did is it rolled back that earlier decision and returned to the spirit of the open meetings law, which is that you have to be as public as possible.
Let's move to the presidential candidacy of former Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson. Here's what he had to say earlier this week.
Whether there's only two of us participating, three, six, seven, or eight, it's going to be an event.
He's talking, of course, about the Iowa straw poll, and he's going forward with his strategy of trying to use that straw poll to rally his campaign. That's despite decisions by former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani and Arizona Senator John McCain to skip the August event. Is Tommy grasping at straws here?
Well, he was right in the sense that it's going to be an event, but I think it's going to be an event without a whole lot of meaning, because now that Giuliani and McCain have dropped out of the straw poll in August, it doesn't. I mean, you take a couple of the top contenders out, and we don't know where Fred Thompson's going to be if he gets in, if he's going to participate. But clearly, the importance of the straw poll has been diluted. And if Tommy comes out on top of the straw poll, or if he comes in second or third or whatever, the impact is just not going to be the same. So, despite all the brave talk, I think it's going to be a meaningless exercise in August in Iowa.
It won't mean a huge amount, but if Tommy Thompson does well in it, it will, keep his candidacy alive or keep it on life support, whatever you'd want to say. I'm rooting for Tommy. I think that among the clowns who are running for the Republican nomination, he's clearly one of the best. He's certainly one of the more moderate and one of the more thoughtful, although he hasn't really done well in conveying that in his public appearances.
He certainly hasn't given a terrific performance in any of the debates. He's had to have clarifications of things that he said on a number of occasions. Seems to be stumbling a little bit. How does he play on the national scene?
Well, he, Tommy is one of those guys who I think was uniquely qualified to be governor of the state of Wisconsin. He was the perfect match for the state of Wisconsin. And I think you can make a case for the fact that he was perhaps the best governor Wisconsin has ever had. Certainly, he's in the top five. It was this symbiotic relationship between Tommy and the people of the state of Wisconsin. At the national level, it's a very different arena that you're playing in, and I think he's finding that out, perhaps to his chagrin a little bit. I mean, the media is sharper, they're more critical, they're less forgiving. Some of what I think Tommy has a way about him that I think a lot of people in Wisconsin found endearing and appealing. And I think at times on the national stage, it doesn't look that way. And he gets criticized for things and he has to clarify things. So it's just different. And I don't know how this is going to play out. You know, Bill said in terms of the candidates, I think I love Tommy. He's a great guy, great governor of the state of Wisconsin. If there was some way to magically put him in the White House, I think he would make a very good president. But getting there is a different ballgame than getting to the governor's mansion in Wisconsin. And whether Tommy has what it takes to successfully navigate those shark-infested national political waters, I think remains to be seen. But so far in the debates and otherwise, there have been some unfortunate stumbles, and they've hurt him. And when you're a candidate who's perceived as being in the lower tier of candidates, and you're trying to break through to be part of the upper tier, those things aren't helpful.
That certainly seems to be the common wisdom. The number of Wisconsin schools that...
Well, I just say I think Tommy Thompson's inspiration about an outsider candidacy is exactly right. You know, these shark-infested waters, they're going to pick on those who are cut and bleeding, and they're going to pick on the front runners.
Yeah, we kill our wounded in politics.
Exactly
and
right.
Somebody who's in that second tier of candidates is in a very strong position. It could have been him. I don't think his candidacy has gone particularly well, but I will not be surprised if the Republican nominee is not one of the so-called current front runners. In fact, I would totally not be surprised if it's Mike Huckabee. I think he is the most dynamic candidate and the one who's got the most momentum race.
He's been the most surprising, I think, in the debates. Just to talk about Huckabee for a second, he's smart, he's affable, mm-hmm. he's got a good sense of humor. Comes across well.
Good personal story.
I have been, you know, and Huckabee was someone that I had sort of written off going into this process, but I have to say, I have been favorably impressed with him. Now, that hasn't showed up in any great difference in the numbers for Huckabee, yeah. but he has been, I think, the most surprising
it's
candidate on
impressive.
The Republican
so,
side.
So to run for president now, do you have to either be from Arkansas or Texas, or what's the deal?
Well,
here?
You know, just on Huckabee's point, thank you for mentioning Arkansas. He had a great opening line in the last debate, you know, when they had to introduce, each of the candidates had to introduce themselves. I don't know if you guys saw it, but here was Huckabee's introduction. I'm from Arkansas, a place called Hope. Perhaps you've heard of us. Give us a second chance. I thought that was a great opening. I thought that was just great.
No Child Left Behind in the news again this week. The number of Wisconsin schools that didn't meet standards of the federal No Child Left Behind Act could possibly face sanctions. That number increased from 87 to 95 this year. Of the 95 schools on the list released by the State Department of Public Instruction, 54 are in the Milwaukee District, and 3 are charter schools. The entire Kenosha and Milwaukee districts are on the list. So more news about No Child Left Behind, and this has been a controversial program for some people since its inception, and I'm not even sure exactly what these numbers mean. Bill, why don't you go first?
Well, you know, this is further proof, if any were needed, that No Child Left Behind is a completely bogus and counterproductive exercise. Its purpose is to isolate and punish school districts who have special challenges. The sanctions will apply in this case to schools only from Milwaukee, but a lot of schools were caught up in this dragnet. Any school that doesn't have a certain percentage of students scoring as proficient classify as failing under this and get a failing report card. And all 4 of Madison's high schools are declared to be failing schools under this program. Anyone who thinks that Madison's high schools are failing schools is out of their mind. These are schools that have tremendous resources, tremendous energy invested into educating students. They do as good a job as anybody can with the population of students with which they're presented. It's just that No Child Left Behind sets this unreasonable standard, and what's more, an escalating unreasonable standard where the expectations will continue to increase so that in a matter of 10 years or so, every school in the country, every school will be declared a failing school.
Rick, you're going to get the last word here. You've got about a minute.
Just quickly, I think accountability is a good thing when it comes to public education, and I think parents and taxpayers have a right to know how well their schools are doing and how the children are performing. And that really is what the whole No Child Left Behind program was all about. Now, it may not be perfect, but if people don't like what they're getting from that particular approach to accountability, then I'd be open to hearing some different ideas and suggestions on how we get there. But I would hope at least we would agree that accountability and raising academic standards and measuring performance are all good things.
Well, I think that's a nice place to leave it. Thank you so much, Bill and Rick, for making this an enjoyable hour. Appreciate your time
you.
And your
Thank
company.
Thank you.
Bill Leaders is news editor of Isthmus, Madison's alternative newspaper, and Rick Berg is former appointee of the Thompson administration, freelance writer and contributing columnist for the Wisconsin State Journal and Capital Times. This program was produced by Leo Duran, who also handled on-air production. It's program 615C, and if you'd like a copy of it, you can call the radio store, 800-747-7444. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.